And I would say it's a crisis on both ends in some ways, because as you switch to institutional subscriptions for the researcher working in a lab, everything is essentially free, because you just go online, you go look at the journal, and there it is, because your library is bought it. I think they will understand the process quite as well, or in some ways lessen the obvious value of our lab has to buy a subscription to this, and I have to put in the password sort of approach. And on the other end, I think it was Joe Esposito who wrote a post about the idea that the librarians are just being seen more and more as sort of purchasing agents rather than as these curators of knowledge and these incredible sources for someone at an institution to go to and to draw on their ability to...
Not intellectual partners.
Exactly. But I do think there's a lot of opportunity for librarians as well. And one of the big crises we're seeing right now in the research community is data storage and organizing. So if you're in a laboratory and you're generating a terabyte worth of movies of cells moving in a week, you have a terabyte every week. How do you store all that stuff? And then how do you annotate it and organize it? So when you leave that laboratory, you finish graduate school or you move to another institution, how is that data retained? How can the next person who comes into the laboratory access that same data, pick up your experiments? And I think there's a huge potential for librarians whose real expertise is organizing and annotating and things like that of information. And I think there's a role to expand the active role of the librarian with the researcher, which hopefully will happen in the future.
Yeah. Anything from the audience? Okay, we're going to move on. Nice brunch shot. So the burden of peer review is a topic that you just talked about. And this was inspired by a New York Times article where they were talking about the fact that somebody was complaining about how much of a cost this was creating inside the academic community.
Yeah, the New York Times article was an experiment with, I believe, some history journal saying, well, can we do articles with just post-publication peer review, and scientists had a series of articles also about the sort of flaws in this peer review process. And one of the phrases that came up in all the articles was talking about the burden of peer review, this incredible burden it puts on the researcher. So, you know, I contacted about a dozen biologists and said, well, how many articles are you reviewing? What is the burden? The majority of them said somewhere between one and three articles a month. And at the high end, you have the more senior researchers who are involved in editorial boards, and they would do, you know, 10 to 15 a month. And it was hard for me to think of it in terms of a burden, because one, it's entirely voluntary, and there doesn't seem to be a lot of pressure on you if you say no to an editor, if you can't review that. It doesn't really hurt your career or your ability to publish in a particular journal. So most of it see it, you know, as part of their job. And I quote, you know, one researcher in the article who actually deliberately takes on a lot of articles because he uses them as a training exercise to teach his students and his postdocs how to write an article. He does the review alongside of them, and they sit down and discuss it, and then when the other reviewers, things come back, and the revisions from the office and things like that. And it's really a training exercise in some way. So it was trying to point out some of the unseen benefits, and then the efficiency also of the system. If I review one to three articles a month, and I read 50 articles a month, I know those 50 articles have been at least scrutinized at that same level. And I think if you get rid of peer review and you just have post-publication peer review, then you are now a peer reviewer of 50 articles a month rather than one to three. And there's a great efficiency to the system as it currently exists that I think people are quite recognized.
Any feedback? Is it a burden on our industry or a benefit? Yeah. So speaking of that filtration process, one of the other things we talked about in the scholarly kitchen is this flood of papers. The fact that, yeah, there's peer review, but there's such a promulgation of journals that 50% of papers ultimately, in some cases 90% of certain journals get published. So they get a brand of a journal, they get to say they were published in a journal, they get an impact factor associated with it. So, you know, 50, half or more of papers that are deleted were first initially submitted somewhere, ultimately end up being published, how much of a filter do we actually have? And, you know, are we wearing people out? Are we damaging the whole concept of peer review and scrutiny and the filter we put on scholarship? Or is it proper that there's a flood of papers and we should actually lean even further over into allowance of publications and say, all right, it's good to have it out there. It's better that people know, you know, we should have the negative results, the positive results, the useful, the useless. We should all have it out there and just let it be and stop stressing. So, thoughts on that?
So, to a degree, I think it's good to have a lot of papers. There are more researchers, you know, every year we've got more PhD students. There are more people doing research than ever before. We're expanding, you know, China is expanding rapidly, places like that. If you say to a researcher you can't publish, then basically you can't have a job. Then you're going to put half, you say you only publish 50% as many papers, then you put 50% of scientists at work. There has to be some quality control, and I think people do understand brands, and brands of journals are very important. You know, if you read an article in Cell or Science or Nature, it's going to be at a certain level, and I think that is a very valuable filtering mechanism that exists very strongly for most researchers. But the question of trying to cut out the bad science or the mediocre science, and it was something that came up in the keynote yesterday of well, there's so much waste of funding and studies get done that don't get published. The problem is you can't know in advance what's going to be important. And there is a lot of mediocre science being done and a lot of incremental little bits. But I think, you know, as an example, Woods Hole, how many, 20 years ago, there was a guy working on these little pigments in jellyfish. I mean, who cares? It turns out it's green fluorescent protein, which has revolutionized cell biology, developmental biology, just won the Nobel Prize. You know, who would have thought that's one of the things you would have cut out? Because, you know, why bother with the fluorescent pigment in a jellyfish? So it's because we can't be so predictive of knowing in advance what's going to be important. I think it's important to let it all at least be accessible and to create better filters.
So how do you create better filters?
Good question.
I think no.
Right, no, I think the citation is...
And that's another thing we came across, is that only about half paper cited.
Right, so citation, you know, is a form of post-publication peer review that, again, I think is as recognized as it should be.
Or as robust.
Yeah. So that's part of it. I think post-publication peer review can provide an additional layer of filtering, and that gets back to the burden of peer review is not that we need to get rid of peer review, it's that we need to add to it, and there are more ways to make it more robust and have more filtering mechanisms. But I do still think the idea of brands and journals and knowing what you're getting from this journal versus that journal, I think I think those are valuable filtering mechanisms for you as well.
My only thought to add to that is that historically seen the publication vehicle as a filter. And perhaps now at a point where, you know, that's still a kind of filter, but there's some room for additional types of filters on top of that.
Yeah, great.
Sure,
question.
Mark does something to ask for the last week, which goes to science again. Now, I'll sort of sidestep this a little bit. Is it better to publish 50 papers in a journal with an impact factor of less than one than one paper in the New England Journal of Medicine? And how important is it for a student? I mean, we heard yesterday at the Chinese session that Chinese student, to actually get their PhD, they have to collect points to get their PhD from an impact factor.
Well, that's one of the things that I think is actually potentially a bad thing in academia right now. It's strong. I think from what I've heard, it's strongest in Europe, especially continental Europe, but it's creeping in everywhere with HNX and HVAC and all that stuff, is it's all becoming points-driven. You know, it's like you can put a score on somebody and it relieves burdens on time-pressed academics and say, oh, you know, you got 43, so it's on a tenure track. and you don't look more deeply at the substance of what's actually going on in there. So, you know, so again, you know, because the incentives, and this is where we always kind of get back to this culture versus technology and practice. You know, this is really impacting a lot of cultural brands, and some things are being exploited because the culture is slower to adapt to these kinds of changes. So you have this abundance of papers and it's driving careers because the incentives are points driven, and you know, it kind of spills over. So,
yeah. In answer to your question, career wise, it's better to publish one paper in a hugely high impact factor journal. I think, is that better for science, or is it better to have more information out there?
Is it better to win the lottery or to earn a
right? I mean, some little tidbit in your low impact factor thing may, you know, inspire the next revolution in science.
You got a question back there?
Thanks. Jerry Cowley from IOP. I just wanted to make a comment about the flood of papers in relation to the open access movement and how the two connected. I'm not talking about the really predatory open access journals, which Alston Advisor wrote about, but the real respectable ones. Talking especially about PLOS One, which Richard Horton said yesterday, by means of approbation, is now the world's largest journal. Some of us, for instance, at IOP and many of the other publishers in this room, when we receive papers, the first filter we ask is it interesting, is it important? And if it answers yes to that, then we get it refereed to make sure that the methodology is correct and, you know, the results justified by so and so. I've heard Peter Binfield, PLOS One, give a talk in which he says explicitly they do the opposite. When a paper arrives, they pay no attention whatsoever as a policy to whether it's important or interesting. They only get a referee to see whether it has been conducted accurately and the results do indeed reflect the method that's been used. And so by virtue of that, the people paying for publications become the world's biggest journal. And of course, it was published in papers. There's one all over the newspapers this morning. It's actually called PLOS One. But I think we need to consider whether we want that huge rump of scientific papers to be published at a cost in that way.
Right. And that was one of the subjects of a post that I put up with one of the 96 comments on it. Because I think there are two problems with PLOS with PLOS One. One is they are trying to, with a brand of PLOS, trying to have PLOS Medicine, PLOS Biology, which are stringent journals, more stringent journals. And they have PLOS One, which is a less stringent journal. I think it's a branding conflict. What does PLOS stand for? And I don't think they have that down. And I do think there's a problem with the 70% acceptance rate. You will occasionally get a hit, like a really good paper will come through, you know, but you won't necessarily have seen it come. So, you know, it's a debate that's going to go on. We have to stay in the spirit of the lightning round. So, care to share some supplemental data? What do we think about the Journal of Neuroscience saying no more supplemental data? We can't stand behind it. We aren't going to take the time to peer review it. We're going to narrow down the scope. It's a quality issue. Is that good? How does that bear on the flood of papers? I mean, you can have not only more papers, but you have these papers that are just better in general because they've got all this background data and tables and Excel files nobody opens.
I think it's important to point out that they have now made a distinction between supplemental data and online-only material. So they are still, you can still publish a movie or material that's not going to be in the printed model. I think a lot of people miss that concept in the debate of, oh, they're restricted limiting themselves to what they can publish now.
It's more what they can, what they will peer review.
Right. It is something of a problem. It gets back to the sort of data archiving questions. And to me, you know, I asked the question of, is it the place of the publisher to be the data archivist? I think the journal article itself serves a very precise, particular role. If this is the on record, the story of this experiment, and it can be a self-contained thing. And at the same time, it is very valuable to have all the data from that experiment publicly available to another researcher. It really depends on the type of data very specifically. But I'm not sure that publishers are necessarily the place where that data needs to live and to be stored in perpetuity. I think that may be better served by the research institution itself.
Any thoughts?
I second that.
All right. Lightning round. Here we go. And they have editorial fallacy. We're serving that today. This is a post that was just up this week by Joe Esposito, in which he talked about the fact that some publishers think that if you just publish the best book or the best article or the best journal, that'll solve your problem. It's just a matter of quality editorial. And he talks about the fact that no, actually, in this competitive technology and information space, you need to have better distribution, better plans, better strategies, so on and so forth. Are we living with the editorial fallacy?
I'd say the editorial fallacy
And is it a fallacy?
Well, so I don't know if I would agree with Joe that it's a fallacy per se, but I do think that there is a historic focus on editorial and production as sort of the two core units of a publishing house. And while those things are still vitally important, of course, I don't think they're differentiators. And so to the extent to which publishers want to differentiate themselves, I think competition and hence value is moving to other areas, to experimentation around business models, to better technology, to being able to build applications that take information that publishers are delivering deeper into workflows, these sorts of things.
I don't think, and I think Joe's essentially right, but I also, I don't want to discount the value of quality as a selling factor. We live in an age where we're essentially competing with free, and if you think of sort of iTunes versus BitTorrent at this point, there's a matter of convenience which we can offer, and there's no matter of quality. You can spend all day on BitTorrent trying to download a song or a low bandwidth thing that's half of the song, this or that, or you can spend 10 seconds on iTunes, pay 99 cents, and you're getting a full bandwidth, nice version of the song. So that is, that is a value that we can add, that things are embedded, that they're edited, that they're clearly presented. And I think it's something that people will continue to pay for. And we talked about the time pressures that people are under. Most people don't have time. It gets back to the question of quantity of publishing. Most people don't have time to filter through 1,300 papers a month to find the two that are particularly interesting, and that's where these sort of brands and some of the work the filtering that we can add, we can do the work that people don't have time to do and don't want to do themselves, and if we do it well, then it's worth paying for.
Okay. So what do you prefer, culture or technology? Do you like our current culture, or do you want to change it with a little bit of technology?
I think the argument we made in it's one of Phil Davis's favorite arguments, is that culture always trumps technology. And it's kind of the talk I gave today is you have all these totally cool technologies, and they make sense for a culture. Facebook's make sense because you want to connect with people from your past. It's this great tool. But there's nothing in a culture that is driving usage of things like that in scientific research, for example.
Right, so Michael's post today is basically, we don't know how the culture is going to change. If you take too short-term a view, you think culture's stable, but you start to look ahead and you realize the culture's going to be completely transformed. It's happened before. It will happen again. So, do you have any...
And I think it will happen faster. I think one of the things with... David would agree with me on this. There's a lot of talk about, and he sort of mentions the idea of, there's not, people have tried to make a Facebook for scientists, and the point is it already exists called Facebook. And so it's not that scientists aren't using Facebook and LinkedIn and other things. They are using it, they're just not using it for work. But I think that one of the things that is interesting to me about Web 2.0 is that it has replicated a lot of things that are already happening within scientific and scholarly publishing. And I think that's some of the challenge is figuring out what to do with things that we're already doing. So, for example, online communities are ways for which, are a tool for which groups that don't have a natural community can form a community, whereas in our space, we already have a community, and they already meet. We have scientific societies, we have universities, we have all sorts of communities in existence already. So the question is, do we need these online tools, or our meetings, given up an email and all the other resources that we've had for years, there's comments in our we already have that, it's called letters to the editor, they already exist. So I do think there's a sense in which for our space there's a bit of a solution in the consortium problem. That being said, as the tools become more and more ubiquitous and people are more and more comfortable with them, I can see all sorts of new uses and developing.
I think it's more of a creeping in of we use this in our personal life and we're used to some things like that, and I think that's more and more turning up.
What about cultural incentives?
Well, I mean, you do see, just to clear on what Michael was saying, there are communities already, and I talked about some of these online communities, the Frog community or this and that, and those actually have fairly active discussion boards going on, and much more so than this sort of for example, the Nature Network is, all of science, and you don't really communicate with all of science. You have your specific community. In some ways, trying to pare these things down into smaller groups. And if you think about the real sorts of groups in which scientists work, you have your lab, and there's also a private versus public, the things you say in private versus public, and this has become an increasing problem in the culture, in the last.
So what happens if private information becomes very valuable?
Well, just in terms of
private,
I'm not going to speak freely. So 20 years ago,
publishers were used to taking everything public.
So 20 years ago, you go to a science meeting and someone would stand up and say, you were just effing around. This is a load of crap. I didn't drop the F bomb, by the way, as Phil did the last time we presented together.
Congratulations.
You would never see that at a meeting at this point. There's this almost fear of publicly insulting someone else. That person may be sitting on your grant committee. That person may be sitting on your tenure committee. That person may be on the hiring committee for your students. So all these discussions that people want to foster online about science, they happen, but they happen on a private level. They happen with the people in your lab or with your collaborators or within your department. And they're very deliberate, closed, trusted circles, and that's a big part of the culture right now that is impeding the technology.
Right. So we're publishers, we're used to taking everything public. Maybe we need to think, because one of the things I've seen in orthopedic surgery, being there a short time, is going back to the because it forgets a session as soon as you're done. You can just make it a risk, because that's what they want. The end of the book. Seems like the end of the book is coming. We talked about the beginning, but it looks like the book is a thing that's sold on consignment and through bookstores. We've got all sorts of fun, Barnes & Noble, we've got the Kindle becoming mainstream, the iPad, self-publishing, print on demand. The book as a form is probably not going away, but the book as we know it and as a commercial presence is probably shrinking. Is that good, bad? Okay.
So one of the issues we're having a lot of problems with is getting authors to write for books, because if it's not online, it doesn't exist, is pretty much what we're regularly told. So we're having to, in some ways, and I think everyone else is in this sort of, getting rid of the print-first mentality and creating electronic products first, and then print version is more of an afterthought afterwards. One thing I think would be really interesting to see what happens is if the Google Books settlement has ever worked out, or when Google editions start, and all of a sudden you start getting the search results in the same sort of way as you're looking for scientific information on a particular paper or particular subject, you start getting book content as well, and that may sort of spin around this. It may not be the end of books after all. It may make them suddenly much more accessible than previously, and may add some new life, not necessarily to the form of ink on paper, but to the sort of concept of the curated book collection of material.
And then you have this whole, was it Flipboard, the iPad app, where you can just take your social media and turn it into an app. So
I think that this is two entirely different issues, depending on which space you're in. So if you're in scholarly, in professional publishing, it's one issue. And I think if you're in trade book publishing, it's a totally different issue. Scholarly and professional publishers have done a really good job of building their brands. It matters. It matters what you're a professor. It matters what university professor or publisher, commercial publisher, publisher. If you're an obviously if you're a scientist, it matters what you're a journal publisher. And moreover, scientific societies and commercial publishers have, because the authors and readers are often the same community, have deep connections within that community of reader authors. Whereas if you're a trade book publisher, your brands are more or less worldwide. Nobody goes to the bookstore and goes, hey, I'm going to get ahead of this brand I have to. And you have no connection to readers because your customers have historically been bookstores, not people, not readers. And because you have a few authors relative to the number of readers out there, you have very few connections into that community. So I think they're in a much different state.
I'm going to skip over these because we're basically out of time. But the impact factor is probably another thing that's going to be looked at in the network world. People are becoming less and less patient. And one of the main themes of all of this is which is better, abundance or scarcity? We come from a world in which scarcity defined what we did. And we made it easy to do business because it's easy to sell things that are rare, easy to price them. Once you have abundance and people have technology that is essentially as good as yours, what's your differentiator? And how do you actually make yourself special? And I think we have huge questions. I always, when I go through this or when I go through a set of posts on the kitchen, it feels like I can see like little hints of how this is all going to come together somewhere, sometime. So, this is the charge for this session. It was zero. Okay, this is on us. And I hope to see you on the Scholarly Kitchen.